tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night. What immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burnt the fire of thine eyes? On what wings dare he aspire? What the hand dare seize the fire?
William Blake's poem, The Tiger, is one of the most famous in the language, a childhood favourite. But like the poet himself, it's often misunderstood. Blake, the visionary London poet and engraver who, at the age of 8, saw on Peckham Rye a tree filled with angels, their bright wings bespangling every bough like stars, is sometimes dismissed either as a naive eccentric, the author of simple verses and bewildering epics, or as the patriot who gave us the lines we know as the anthem Jerusalem. But Blake was a radical. His illustrated poems are among the great works of the English Romantic imagination. And for all his seeming unworldliness, he was vitally connected to and shaped by the revolutionary times in which he lived.
He was a Republican, a dissenter. His was always the pursuit of personal, social, and sexual liberty. For him, liberty was the byword for life.
Blake was extraordinarily radical across the board because he was determined to do what other artists hadn't done. He said that he wanted his books to be seen as a phenomenon. He did not want to produce an ordinary book. And, of course, that was part of his profile as a prophet.
There is the fascination with occult forms of religious experience, with vision, with breaking free of meter and rhyme.
Although Blake is such a singular creature, initially he's also identified with the London mob. He's there when Newgate Prison is burnt in his red cap. He responds to the spirit of the American Revolution and the French Revolution, and wonders, really, can this not be happening in England? Shouldn't we be disposing of the kings and the corruptions of politics and Parliament? And more than anything else, it is this spirit of luminous nonconformity that he represents.
Throughout his life, Blake created his own mythology in words and pictures. He personified England as the character Albion, and in the early optimistic phase of the French Revolution, he depicted Albion in a blaze of colour as a vigorous and joyful young man.
This is Albion Rose, which is one of Blake's colour-printed engravings, which he then finished with pen and ink and watercolour.
This is Robin Hamlin, curator of British art in Tate Collections.
It shows Albion rising. He stands on a rock, which one can define as Albion itself. And this wonderful figure of a man, beautiful coloured skin, of course, he is there with his arms outstretched, with the sun rising behind him.
But the promise of a new dawn of universal liberty wasn't realised. And it was as the revolution in France turned to terror, with revolutionaries branded as ravening beasts, that Blake wrote The Tiger. Tom Paulin.
What the hammer? What the chain? In what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil? What dread grasp dare its deadly terrors clasp? When the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears, did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? Tiger is very much a political poem centered on the French Revolution, on the September massacres, the terror. And really, it is a poem about how there is a tiger of revolution. And it's important to recognize that in the 1790s, the Parisian mob was often described in the London Times as tigers. It has a mythic dimension. He says, on what wings dare he aspire? And he's thinking about Icarus flying too close to the sun. Then the next question is, what the hand dare seize the fire? Well, that's obviously Prometheus stealing fire fire from the gods. So again, Prometheus and Icarus are symbols of revolution.
Hello, I'm Niall McDevitt. I'm a poet living in Hammersmith, and I'm guiding people today on the William Blake Walk. He was born on November 28th, 1757, and so this year is Blake's 250th anniversary. Now we're standing outside 17 South Moulton Street. This is the only surviving house that William Blake lived in. William and Catherine, his wife, lived on the first floor. Blake was a Londoner, as was Catherine. Blake was born in London and lived almost his whole life in London.
Blake had been apprenticed to an engraver in Covent Garden. He had no formal education, since apparently he so despised restraints and rules that his father dare not send the young Blake to school. And he later rejoiced, saying, "Thank God I never was sent to school to be flogged into following the style of a fool." He married Catherine Boucher, the beautiful daughter of a market gardener, and taught her to read, to mix paints and prepare engraving plates. They were happy. Blake was once discovered in his little back garden, sitting naked in the sun under a tree with Catherine, reading Paradise Lost. "Come in," he called to his friend. "It's only Adam and Eve, you know." He took in engraving commissions from publishers and worked unceasingly on his own visionary books. But Blake's London was in tumult. Stirred up with demands for liberty and equality and with enthusiasm for Tom Paine's Rights of Man, London was soon battened down with armed mercenaries imported to quash any possible French invasion and the violence of the London mob. Peter Ackroyd, Blake's biographer.
It was a dangerous time in the London of the 1780s and 1790s. It was a time of riot and insurrection. There were coal heavers' riots and silk weavers' riots. There were riots about the lack of bread or the expensiveness of bread. There were riots concerned with John Wilkes, with the general cry of Wilkes and Liberty against what was considered to be the old corruption of the political regime. And then, of course, in 1780, there were the famous Gordon riots, where the whole of London fell under the impress of the mob, riots in which Blake himself was caught up. So it was, in general, perhaps the most incendiary and inflammatory period of London's history.
This is Hanover Square, and this is dedicated to the Hanoverian dynasty. These were the imported German royals, and in Blake's time, George III was the reigning monarch. He reigned for a very long time. He came in when Blake was three. Remember that in the 1790s, William Pitt brought in a series of sedition acts, which led to a total clampdown on free speech, free thinking, free expression in the arts. So I think we can safely conclude that Pitt was no friend of Blake's, and vice versa.
Blake rebelled against all the institutions of state and church. He saw them as enslaving, oppressive, a fettering of the imagination, and of those old liberties that he believed people had enjoyed in Britain long ago. Blake said, "The nature of my work is visionary or imaginative. It is an endeavour to restore what the ancients called the Golden Age."
One of the wonderful, fascinating things about Blake is that he did see himself as a prophet, and there was no great grandeur attached to that role, although he was extremely conscious of the fact that it was a poet's and an artist's role to think deeply about society and the age in which he lived.
And at the start of Blake's illuminated epic poem Jerusalem, he gives us a clue to how he sees that prophetic mission.
The frontispiece to this shows a figure with a hat. Like a night watchman, he carries his lantern, and he's just entering a door, and he's descending some steps. The steps lead to the underworld of Albion, where so much of the corruption of the Albion of his own times can be found and needs to be sorted out. The figure of the night watchman is characterized as loss, and loss in Blake's mythology is the artist. So we have here a self-portrait of the artist who sets out somehow to act as a prophet and warn people that something has to be done about this country if it is to be saved. And if Jerusalem, which means liberty, if liberty is to be re-established in the United Kingdom.
O rose, thou art sick. The invisible worm that flies in the night in the howling storm has found out thy bed of crimson joy, and his dark secret love does thy life destroy.
One of the greatest of English lyrics, I think, is The Sick Rose. This little poem is really a version of Paradise Lost in 8 very short lines. So the invisible worm is all that's represented by Satan in terms of monarchism, the established order that's trying to overthrow what's represented by the Garden of Eden, which is the English Commonwealth. The howling storm is the storm, I think, of his present existence with the struggle for greater freedom on the part of the English people, which is the bed of crimson joy. Also, it's about the whole atmosphere of secrecy surrounding politics, and his dark secret love does thy life destroy. It was set to music by Benjamin Britten during the early years of the Second World War, and so the invisible worm is the Nazi threat, and England is the bed of crimson joy.
Whether set to music by Benjamin Britten or sung by Allen Ginsberg, the beat poet who famously hallucinated and heard Blake's commanding voice in his Harlem apartment in 1948, Blake's poems frequently lend themselves to performance. In Songs of Innocence and Experience, in which he dresses complicated philosophical ideas in the guise of poems addressed to children, we hear echoes of the ballads and nursery rhymes that Blake himself would have heard on the streets of London. Robin Hamlin.
One problem for Blake was that he couldn't write music. So although he could sing his songs, and we have one particular record of how he would sing his songs in front of other people, and he loved music, he sang throughout his life, and he had musical or singing friends around him. So he, I think, in aiming to produce the illuminated book, he was looking for a substitute for the music. And the decorations around the edges and within the text in something like the Songs of Innocence was, for me, I think, a substitute for music. And it has many of the musical connotations, like colour, and there's sort of variations, and there's line, and there's tone, all those sorts of things.
In his art, Blake favoured the flowing Gothic line rather than the mathematical precision of the prevailing classical style. He told the artist Samuel Palmer that he was inspired by the time he spent in the vast labyrinth of Westminster Abbey as a young man, sketching the ancient tombs and monuments. Blake was uncomfortable with Enlightenment science and with Newtonian physics in particular. He wanted to awake Britain from the cold rule of reason. For Bacon and Newton, he wrote, sheathed in dismal steel, their terrors hang like iron scourges over Albion. He thought that rationalists were overwhelming the imaginative and spiritual faculties of mankind, grinding everything down to what might be measured, weighed and costed. The writer and poet Ian Sinclair.
He doesn't like society and doesn't like Joshua Reynolds and he doesn't like fashion, you know. He thinks these things are more than banal. They're seriously corrupting to the human spirit. And I think he thinks there are eternal verities and that maybe he alone has recognised them. It's on the edge of what would be described as mad or insane because nobody else agrees with him. And yet he's perfectly in control, and visited by the spirits of the ancient dead, he greets them as people coming into the room for a cup of cocoa. They just sit quietly with him and they have these debates and discussions. And he isn't a kind of raging, red-eyed lunatic. He's somebody who is able to see through the membrane of the banal and recognize things that other people don't see.
we are at St. George's Church, just down from Hanover Square. Lovely old church, closed today, we can't go in. But this apparently is where Mr. and Mrs. Blake got married. Blake's parents. They're both nonconformists, and his son inherited that propensity. They didn't like the Church of England much, because the king was head of the church, and they were Republicans. So they looked elsewhere for alternative Protestantisms to get into, and so there's a large menu: Unitarianism, Quakerism, Methodism, Swedenborgianism, Moravianism. But some people think that Blake's mum was Moravian, and that's where Blake got this theories of free love and all that, Blake's kind of crazy sexual ideas that he's never actually able to fulfill, but he just dreamt about all the time.
Blake believed in sexual freedom, and there are some reports that he tried to introduce a second wife into the household. As a man of unorthodox beliefs, he found himself very much at home and very productive in a particular corner of London, Lambeth.
Lambeth itself was what you might call friendly territory. It was, in some respects, a louche and even disreputable quarter. It was a place of makeshift entertainment with taverns and pleasure gardens, but it's also a place where insurrectionaries used to gather, a place where people like the transvestite spy Chevalier Déon lived. It was a sort of area just outside the city and therefore a haven for the less respectable denizens of the neighbourhood.
Blake's poem London epitomises his outrage against social injustice in a nightmare vision of the city.
I wander through each chartered street, near where the chartered Thames does flow, and mark in every face I meet marks of weakness, marks of woe. In every cry of every man, in every infant's cry of fear, in every voice, in every ban, the mind-forged manacles I hear. How the chimney sweepers cry, every blackening church appalls, and the hapless soldier's sigh runs in blood down palace walls. But most through midnight streets I hear how the youthful harlot's curse blasts the newborn infant's tear and blights with plagues the marriage hearse.
London is enchained, despairing, cruel. Even the flowing Thames is chartered, by which he means regulated, mapped, constrained. Pauper boys as young as 4 are crushed into twisted chimneys to work as sweeps. Youths are sent to war, returning to chalk their curses on the royal walls, as indeed many did. Young girls walk the streets diseased and wretched. All are emblems of the angelic body and spirit, warped by the rules of church and state, exiled from innocence. Blake's London has been an inspiration to many artists. Clio Barnard is a contemporary artist and filmmaker who came to know Blake's work as a child.
Well, my stepfather's a composer and my mum sings, and he had set Blake's poems to music. So I knew them from a very early age as songs.
I wander through each chartered street, near where the chartered Thames does flow.
I knew the words of the poems as lyrics, really. And I knew that Blake lived in Lambeth, and that was when he wrote Songs of Innocence and Experience. And I was living in Lambeth myself at the time, so I proposed this film, which was taking Blake's poems as a starting point, really, and to explore contemporary Lambeth.
I wandered through each chartered street, near where the chartered Thames does flow.
So in London, he's angry about the poverty that he encounters. And living in Brixton, you encounter these faces of people who are suffering or who are living in poverty.
In every voice, in every band.
What I then did was went and interviewed lots of people that I met on the street. And there was one woman called Nazmoon, who is the person who kind of leads you through the film. It's structured as this nocturnal journey through Lambeth. She encounters a night shift worker, somebody who works in a bakery, and she encounters a guy who cleans windows at traffic lights and a street cleaner.
There's a lot to do with timing and with the lights, because I do the front and back windscreen. A lot of people just do the front windscreen.
And the reason that seemed to connect to Blake for me is because Blake tells us that everything that lives is holy and that Jerusalem is London and you can have a vision on Peckham Rye. Those poems completely connect with my experience of London.
So you spent 9 years in Lambeth, hugely creative years, really it's at its peak in some ways. Marriage of Heaven and Hell, Songs of Experience, most famously done there. Also great visionary works, Visions of the Daughters of Albion. Endless things there. And he's also managing to do very well as an engraver. So this is the only time in his life Blake and Catherine have a whole house. They rent a whole house, not just one room. Nearby was Albion Mill. There weren't that many factories in London at the time, but nearby Blake was a proto-factory called Albion Mills. And so that's where the Satanic Mills comes in. Nice to think of Albion and Mills together. And also then Bedlam, they built an enormous lunatic asylum, Nuthouse, and they call that Bedlam. So Blake's really working between Albion, Mills and Bedlam down in.
Knowing what we do about Blake, it's ironic that the lines we call Jerusalem should have been fashioned into an anthem of patriotic pride. The dark Satanic Mills may have been inspired by Albion Mills in Lambeth, but they also refer to the mills of materialism that grind and suppress spiritual life. It's not what we think. Boris Johnson.
Oh yes, this is the number one all-time smash hit. Public school hearty hymn to rock your socks off, because you're standing there. The thing strikes up, by which time all the sort of pathetic public school hearties who are leaving school or whatever they're doing start blubbing with emotion, and they then belt into this incredibly, ridiculously, preposterously patriotic song, which seems to suggest that there is a special place in the universe for the English, and that the great city of God could at some stage have been built here, and perhaps it is here now. Amongst these dark Satanic mills, and it is, I suppose, moments of emotion deeply intoxicating and satisfying.
Those arguments that it's over-patriotic, I think, are undermined by the question marks in it. And did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green? Question mark. And was the Holy Land of God? Well, was it? Do you think that Jesus ever came here? I mean, that's one way of looking at it. I've always preferred to see it as if Jesus turned up tomorrow here in England, what do you think he'd say? Would he say, well done? Or would he say, hang on a minute, no, this isn't what I had in mind? That's the message. It's a questioning message. Have we done enough? Do we deserve to live in a shining city on a hill, or could we actually make this better? That's the first verse. The second verse, come on in, well, bring me these things. Bring me my chariot of fire. And let's not cease from mental fight till we have built. So every time you sing it, it's the prospect of a better world. And I think that's why we're so stirred by it.
Billy Bragg. Blake was the last person who would have written lines encouraging a nostalgic, conservative view of England. Quite the opposite. Ian Sinclair.
He didn't know the romantic Lake District visions of Wordsworth and De Quincey and Coleridge. His England was not this England of the hymnal. It wasn't that at all. The Jerusalem lyric is about a possibility of redeeming the soot and murk, not necessarily of the city, but of our own consciousness, that we can rescue our own souls and be burning cherubs of gold again, and that the city of the imagination can be superimposed upon London.
The fields from Islington to Marybone, to Primrose Hill and St. John's Wood.
He understood the spiritual entity of the city. He saw in the streets and alleys of London the lineaments of eternity. He saw London as an infinite city. He thought of Jerusalem as a great city of art, which somehow still dwelled within the bosom of the city, but which was not seen. It was a city of freedom, of inspiration, of vision, but I don't think it was one that he ever expected to see, at least not in the material sense.
Blake knew other radicals in London, Tom Paine, the painter Henry Fuseli, and Mary Wollstonecraft, author of A Vindication of the Rights of Woman. But Blake was not a joiner. His vision and his art were highly idiosyncratic, and he was in some ways a vulnerable man.
Blake was always possessed by what he called nervous fear, and one of his fears was of arrest, and he had a great fear of authority. This came out in his youth, for example, when he was interviewed and, well, interrogated, when he was found sketching ships along the Medway. He was considered to be a spy. But the major point in his life when he was actually accused of sedition was in 1803.
Blake and Catherine had moved down to Felpham in Sussex. In August 1803, a drunken soldier called Schofield came lurching into the Blake's garden and refused to leave. An argument followed.
Come closer to me and I'll knock your eyes out.
What are you doing?
I'm thrusting you out of my garden.
Schofield, as revenge, made up a story that Blake, unprovoked, assaulted him, and that Blake had said, "Damn the king, the soldiers are all slaves."
Next thing, he's charged with assault and sedition. This is, without a doubt, the most nightmarish, most trying time in Blake's life, the great ordeal. It's the ultimate clash with the authorities. You know, in a worst-case scenario, Blake himself might be hung, drawn, and quartered for this sedition charge.
Blake was tried but found not guilty. But he never really recovered from the ordeal, and the older artist had to resign himself to obscurity. Very few copies of his books were printed, and almost nobody came to his one-man exhibition. But 250 years after his birth, Blake's reputation outshines most of his forgotten contemporaries. He remains an inspiration for artists who combine a love of liberty with revolutionary politics and a concern for social justice. When Blake died on 12th of August 1827, those who knew him found it hard to decide whether he was a madman or a genius. But he was consoled to the last by his visions and his work. He went cheerfully, laying his pencil aside and telling his weeping wife that they would never be parted, but be together always. Just before he died, a friend told Samuel Palmer, his countenance became fair. His eyes brightened, and he burst out singing of the things he saw in heaven.
The Poet of Albion was presented by Jenny Uglow and produced by Susan Marling. The programme was a Just Radio production for BBC Radio 4. And our series celebrating the 250th anniversary of the birth of Blake continues later today. Firstly, here on Radio 4 in our afternoon reading, Sally Hawkins will read a story inspired by the poem Jerusalem, following the shared fortunes of two sisters living on opposite sides of the world. Demonstrating Grace is at 3:30. Then, later this evening, two programmes back-to-back will include our Book at Bedtime at 11:15, Burning Bright, in which a family from Dorset are beginning to settle into their new life in Lambeth, living next door to the eccentric poet. Then, at 11:00, you can head over to Radio 3, where the poet Tom Paulin, who we've just heard, will be exploring the songs of experience. That's in The Essay tonight at 11:00, over on BBC Radio 3. Well, back to this morning here on Radio 4. Call You and Yours will be taking your calls on the police service just after the news. First, a look ahead to Saturday morning.
Hi, I'm Howard Stern. Now, if that name doesn't mean anything to you, it's because you're in Britain.
The most notorious, the most censored, and the most fined broadcaster in America.
I pray for Howard Stern. He's hurt a lot of people.
My show has been so shut down by the government, by the religious right, by outside forces.
Oh no, it's lesbianism going on in front of me. Yeah!
BBC Radio 4 hears from Howard Stern's critics, supporters, and from the man himself.
It's dangerous to shut people like me up.
The best DJ you've never heard in your life. The Howard Stern Story is this Saturday morning at 10:30.
BBC News at midday. Gordon Brown's monthly news conference is getting underway, with the Prime Minister expected to face tricky questions about how much he knew about the contravention of...